Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
The cops, look out there! Stand back!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me.
As you've no doubt heard, the 75th anniversary of War of the Worlds passed earlier this week. And you recall, of course, that Orson Welles' 1938 radio play about a Martian invasion set off a mass national panic. Here's Welles in a press conference following that broadcast.
You might have taken advantage of the public.
I simply don't know. I can't imagine an invasion from Mars would find ready acceptance.
We are speaking of gullibility on an epic scale. But according to University of Maine journalism professor Michael Sokolow, the gulls weren't the radio listeners of 1938. They are us. Sokolow and co-author Jefferson Pooley wrote in Slate this week, there was no widespread freakout over the Mercury Theater on the Air broadcast. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So let's start with who all heard the War of the Worlds episode when it was actually broadcast back in 38.
We don't really know. We don't have, you know, accurate numbers, but there were two surveys done that are particularly important. One was done the night during the show, and it found that 98% of the listening audience was listening to something else or didn't have their radio on. And then there was a CBS survey done the next morning that also showed that barely anybody heard it and that those who did hear it knew it was a drama.
But there was a particular piece of scholarship that helped advance and perpetuate the myth. Tell me about Hadley Cantrill.
He was running the Princeton Radio Research Project when this incredible story occurred. His book called The Invasion from Mars is very slim on the actual data, and it's filled with these sensationalistic, lurid accounts of people telling him these narratives of fright. Cantrill himself is clear about the limitations of his study. Okay, so he does say there were over 12,000 newspaper articles that they had in this research project, and they tried to track down names from the research article, and they found less than six people. The problem is people bought his book like crazy because it validates the panic.
Banner headlines about this mass panic. Where did those reports come from, and how did they wind up getting that much play?
The reports came from newsrooms that didn't have much news. It was the day before Halloween. But the second place they came from is the context of something called the press radio war in the 1930s. During that decade, newspapers were dying off. They were losing a lot of advertising revenue. The newspaper owners and the newspaper industry did not like the radio industry, which was growing and gaining a lot of business at their expense. For years, these two industries had been fighting. You had economic and business power all shifting towards radio. When this opportunity occurred, newspapers had something to attack radio's credibility that they had never had before. In certain areas, the telephone exchanges did get flooded. I'm not saying that didn't happen. And people did call the police. I'm not saying that didn't happen. But, you know, the question you have to ask is that reaction rational or irrational? Is that panic? What do you do when you hear something you're not sure about? You check up on it. And so we don't know what happened in those telephone calls. We can't assume that everybody was scared out of their wits.
Let's say it was sensationalized. How did it survive the aftermath of that news cycle?
The story actually makes us feel good. We feel superior to that audience. We're smart enough. We're critical enough. We never would have fallen for this. But it makes us feel good in the same way when, for instance, the Chinese media picks up a humorous story from The Onion and plays it straight. I mean, this has been studied by media scholars for a long time, that we all believe that other people are a lot more persuadable in the media than we are.
This story came up in our story meeting based on your article, and I was shocked because I myself have accepted the notion of mass panic, and I have heard, seen, or read probably hundreds of stories about it, which means at least hundreds of times in the last 75 years, journalists have missed the opportunity to bring to bear any journalistic skepticism and due diligence, which bespeaks mass professional failure. Should I not be in despair over this?
No, CBS has never released their data on it. Why? Because this is about the power of the media. The media industry is premised on the idea that we can persuade people to behave in certain ways. This story is the greatest illustration of that.
You believe that there is a kind of institutional conspiracy on the part of all broadcast media?
No, I would say it in the following way, that the broadcast industry, and I'm including here broadcast advertising, make certain assumptions about the powers they have over the mass audience that align perfectly with this story. I don't think it's conscious of them to cover up the idea of what happened. I think they believe it happened.
Now, just in the past few days on PBS and from WNYC's own radio lab, you heard stuff about the War of the Worlds so-called panic that you know not to be true. It persists.
It persists for a very simple reason. Both Radiolab and PBS chose to use a piece of scholarship from 1940 to base their program upon. Think about this for a second, Bob. If you were to make a documentary today about the Civil War or the Jazz Age, don't you think you'd use newer scholarship than from 1940?
Now, there's one other interpretation of these events, and I must run it past you. I saw it in a comment on an NPR news blog by a listener whose handle is Frisco John. And he sees things slightly differently. I quote, "This is all part of a massive campaign of disinformation from our current Martian overlords. Long live the resistance." Your thoughts?
I'd just like for the record to say I love that I've been attacked as part of a Martian conspiracy, but I'm really from the Sea of Tranquility.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Sokolow is an associate professor of communication and journalism at the University of Maine. And here's a statement from the producer of American Experience, the PBS show he criticized. Quote, "The producers drew on a wide range of scholarship through interviews with several historians and cultural critics. We did make a very conscious nod to the work others have done. Hadley Cantrill's reputable research has been a primary source for many who have written on the broadcast, and we saw no compelling reason not to use it." Radiolab said, quote, "We'll be including an interview with Sokolow in our hour, and we're excited to include his perspective."
Here's 50s talk show host Steve Allen explaining that he and his aunt and mother briefly believed the broadcast was real while at a hotel in Chicago.
Then we burst into the lobby, which to our great surprise was absolutely calm. People reading, smoking cigars, dozing in the chairs by the potted palms. And something immediately told me that that was inconsistent with the end of the world.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Zach Spencer and Megan Tehan, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Rick Kwan.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.